Hello, and welcome to Data for All, a quest for digital autonomy, a podcast in which we bring you closer to the topic of municipal data sovereignty. This season of the podcast revolves around sustainable data solutions for citizens and companies. Looking at situations across Europe, we present facts, approaches, and reflections on how we can better understand and use data for the public good.
Data for All. A quest for digital autonomy. A podcast from the Heinrich Böll Foundation, Schleswig-Holstein.
Hey, Katharina. First of all, it's great that you've taken the time to talk to me here on the Data for All podcast today. Warm welcome to you.
Thank you so much, Max.
So you and I, we already know each other, but for everyone else listening today, would you like to briefly introduce yourself? Who are you and what do you focus on in your work?
Thank you so much for having me here, Max. I'm Katharina. I'm the head of the Feminist Digital Policy Division at the headquarters of the Heinrich Böll Foundation. And to be more precise, I'm working at the feminist think tank of the Heinrich Böll Foundation called Gunnar Werner Institute. And I would call myself a passionate utopian cyberfeminist who is more or less actively involving in the humble attempt to make the internet a little bit fairer and to make AI a little bit more, how to say it, nicer. I mean, we get to this point, I think, later in the podcast. And therefore, I'm writing a lot of very smart and sometimes funny short pieces like articles, going to podcasts with wonderful hosts like you, Max, but also having some workshop series called Knitting Your Own AI or DIY Feminist AI or Barbie Meets Cyberfeminism 2.0. So this is me being feminist activist in the internet.
Yeah, perfect. And I already mentioned we're going to talk a lot about AI as well today. So first of all, the term gender digital divide. I mean, you know it, and also some circles know it, but perhaps a very naive question. How exactly are gender and data connected?
I think, first of all, we have to admit that the gender digital gap means that there are differences between all kind of genders by using the internet, by having access to the internet, or to be more precise, to the digital sphere. This means that, for example, women participate a little bit less in the internet. They have less access to go online, which also becomes more significant when we see where they're located in the world. For example, in the global majority, we have like a bit more problems, to say so. But also when it comes to the question of class, so poor women have less access to the internet. And also the question is, do have, for example, disabled women less access to the internet? This kind of numbers are not yet taken or be published because, unfortunately, there is no money. If we look, for example, in Germany. And now to your question, what makes this injustice so significant? I would say that gender is always written into the infrastructure of the internet. And by this, I mean, of course, the data, because data is the infrastructure of the modern internet. And by this, I mean, I mentioned it, like many data samples, many data sets are not taken. This is like often in the case of AI, the most relevant or most public example is this of the Gender Shades project, which was founded in, I think, 2018, and there Joy Bovani actually tested how well AI could recognize faces on the basis of race and gender. And in her famous studies, she found out that AI definitely has problems to detect black faces and to detect black female faces. Because in the training sets of these face recognition apps and the audit samples, which are like little tests for AI, how significant they can detect faces, she found out that the faces in these data sets were mostly white and mostly male. So we have there a data gap, which means that marginalized people don't appear in these data sets, which makes the technology which relies on this data highly biased or highly insensitive for people who are marginalized. We have the same thing with speech recognition. Therefore, for example, trans women are not recognized as women, but as men, which is like a super high misgendering issue and a, like really safety problem for them. And this is also because in this huge data sets, there are often no voices of trans women. So to make it short, data is often exclusively relay on white middle-class men. We have to look at other examples. For example, face recognition when it comes to border control at the EU borders. Therefore, we have, of course, a lot of faces of color, faces from people who are refugees, from the global minority where AI is tested on. So I would say there is also not just a gap in data, which is not accessible, or to be more precise, the question of who counts into a data set also relays on the question of the end product of this data set. So to say it, if you have a service app, if you have something which helps you, if you have something which should gain you a lot of money, then, of course, you have, sorry to say, white men in the front of the design process as the imagined user and so on. And if it comes to control some sorts of people, some sorts of groups, you often have like marginalized people, marginalized communities, which already are under highly controlled.
Yeah, I mean, we always see that it's very complex and it's not just one topic when it comes to such kind of stuff. So in your opinion, I just looked up for the research before that our former chancellor, Angela Merkel, she said in 2013, the internet is, so to say, Newfoundland for everybody. So basically the internet and all what comes with the AI is relatively new when we look into the past. So in your opinion, what are the main reasons that this imbalance has come about in the first place? So why is the gender digital gap so big right now?
Thanks, Max, for saying this, because in my workshop, Knitting Your Own AI, and also in my workshop, Feminist DIY AI, I always have a little intro info talk, which I call the fifth myth about AI. And one is the so-called, it's a super new problem myth, because I don't think so. Because AI was developed in 1958, and it was just a marketing term. Because the people, like, as I told you, white middle-class professors at Dartmouth need some funding for their summer school. And so they like coined the term AI. And I think it's super smart, to be fair with you. But already there, it was like highly biased. Because, of course, there are no women, there are no black people, there are no trans people, etc., etc. So the term was coined by old men. And then we have the whole development over like 70 years from now on, which are highly dominated by this group. For me, it's no surprise that people who are not this specific type of persons are excluded. I mean, for me, it's totally logic, because not because of bad intentions back then, but they don't see it. And I think this is what sexism, racism, ableism is all about. It's like an invisible structure, which makes it super easy for people in power places to say, oh, shit, we forgot about that. But it was not a bad intention, and we all get that. And to give you some examples, at first place when computer were developed, and this was like long before the internet was developed, it was also a female task because people have to like really type in the mathematic operations. And it was like a female computer. Women did all the work. And of course, there were middle-class white women who did all the work, for example, in England during the World War II. When it comes to Enigma, the decoding machine for the Nazi code. And after that, in the 60s, 70s, it slowly shifted because like computers become a little bit more accessible. And in the 80s, 90s, with the home computer, this huge kind of industrial revolution where like computer gets a market, algorithms in the US were declared to private property, and then slowly men becoming these computers or computer experts now. They get a high school diploma for working in this field, and slowly the salary rises and the shift from a female computer secretary job to a high profile, high paid male job became super clear. And the interesting point is that if you look at the numbers for diplomas in the computer science field, the numbers are sinking. They're not rising when it comes to gender equality. So I think in the 80s or so, we had like 30%, and now it's slowly sinking to 18% in the Western world. And I think it is a slowly structural process which changed over time, and where, again, we have class as a fundamental driver. Because, of course, if it's get high paid, you have a lot of male persons being in the job positions who are also selecting persons like them, unconscious bias. And we see the same with AI, to be a little bit more precise, because we don't have a problem of inequality when it comes to gender and also race when we look at the total jobs in the AI field. But we have a problem when it comes to high-paid jobs like coders, data analysis, like professors, etc. Then we have like an imbalance, which means we have a lot of male white persons. And when it comes to the low-paid, like really precarious jobs, freelance jobs of data labeling, like the capture test, right, to point if there is a traffic light or not, then you have like a lot of female persons from the global south doing the job for like, what, 5 cents per second. So it's not new. It's like very, very fundamental structure of work. Feminists also recognized this in the 70s, like Frigga Hauge, German scientist, wrote like in the 70s about automation and fabric. She pointed out that it's a very male-dominated place where like when it comes to men working in this field, automation in case of robotics were like a huge help, which helps the worker to get the job done. But when it comes to like female jobs, it was also back then the idea and the story that this job will be unnecessary because, of course, the machine could do it because it's a like female job, which it's not worth it. And again, no bad attention, but this is like in a sexist society or in a society which is gendered like ours, of course, female jobs, female related jobs are less worth than male dominated jobs. And the last part to say so is my favorite topic, because often, for example, in Germany, we all know these numbers. We know there are two less women, two less marginalized people in the STEM field, which means science, technology, math, engineering. And the policy ideas to get more women into it. And this is a problem, because also this we know by a lot of studies, also from like not well known for the feminist engagement companies like McKinsey, that the persons, females, black workers, trans workers who are getting into this computer engineering field are dropping out by a higher number than the male colleagues due to, for example, sexual harassment at workplace or constant discrimination because of their race, because of their gender. And for me, we have a wrong a solution in mind. We shouldn't ask why are so few women, but why are so many males, and what can we do to make it more safe and inclusive for people who are not white, cisgendered, and heterosexual males at workplace? And therefore, I think we need like super boring, old anti-discrimination work, which are, I think, not the sexy solution people have in mind when they think about gender gap, AI, discrimination things in general.
Yeah, totally. And you already said that it's nothing new because it started like years ago, not only with the internet. So when I look at it, it's sometimes very obvious because assistance programs such as Siri or Alexa are defined as female, whereas a male person is perhaps more likely to appear online when it comes to finance assistance for a financial advisor. So it is very obvious, you might think. So maybe to go a little bit deeper into this, what do you think, why so many people not know about it? Or is there a lack of awareness, a lack of knowledge, or is it something that goes deeper?
I think it's everything you mentioned, Max. What do I mean by this? I think on first hand, of course, like AI now is such a hype and people are like getting so much AI here, AI there, AI everywhere, and you need it for your job and we need it because otherwise like in 5 years you're on the streets because AI will take your job. And of course, people are getting afraid and trying to catch up and trying to get some future skills, whatever this means. Because like right now, AI is more or less what we have in mind, a chatbot where you type in, hey, official commercial AI version, could you please write me an email for blah, blah, blah. And if I would have an 8-hour paid job where like constantly I get the story that I will be employless in 5 years when I don't use the super customized AI apps on my laptop, then I wouldn't have time to also be aware of discrimination, injustice, imbalance, blah, blah, blah. And also what comes next, what should be my responsibility in this? Because I'm often get asked at the end of this talks, hey, what we should do about it? And I always said, I think it's a policy issue, like traffic. The politicians have the responsibility to really control and regulate AI in this case, that it's designed just, not just fair in the case, okay, we have 50% men, 50% women, which exclude all the other genders, but like really just AI systems where the salary is like evenly distributed for all people, where no data is used, which is not legally origin out of the internet or whatsoever. This is the first thing. The second thing is, like you said, I think there are less awareness. And I think it's a tough job to tell people, really, it is that bad. Because you, of course, want to be the person who say, hey, how cool is it? I'm a feminist. I'm a utopian. And this is what it looks like. And you have to tell people, yeah, but in fact, it's super messed up. And I think it's super hard to change how people think about something. This is the second point. And the last point is, it's also for me a question of, again, who gets to get hurt? Because if you are a huge internet company, and we won't say names here, but if you are, of course, you have so many resources to get hurt by politicians, by civil society, by people, because everyone knows the big names, right? And if you're like a small NGO or just the humble policy advisor, as I am, it's super hard to reach out to so many things. And also, again, like the solutions we have for the persons are not sexy technical solutions where we say, just plug in the feminist app and now everything's fine, but like pay people fair, hey, make good laws for anti-discrimination at workplace, hey, make good housing policies, hey, make like an affordable AI act for people to use it. And now most politicians were out because they took out their little phone and type in the numbers and be like, oh, it's too expensive, thank you, Bye. But super nice to hear you.
Yeah, the holy three. I mean, I would totally agree with what you said. And there's also a lot of awareness, and it takes a lot of time. And people might not like to have such a long way to go. You already mentioned data policies. That's actually perfect because you've also dealt with data policies. And just a question for you, how does data policies and data protection have to do with social power issue?
I think I mentioned it before that, and I wouldn't say social power because I think it's just a purely power question, because data right now is the infrastructure. It's not just like how it said, it's the oil. No, it's structured how AI is used, how different and other software is used and could be used by people. Therefore, data is so fundamental. It's one of the biggest social infrastructure of our time. This is what I would say. Therefore, for example, when it comes to data protection, you need to be protected super well, because the more and more things get digitalized, from your bank account to like how water is distributed in the city to a power plates, this needs to be protected. But to be more precise and not so meta, when we talk about gender issues in the question of data policies, of course, for example, female persons have a super high risk of being exposed by doxing, which means that your address, like your very personal data, is exposed in the internet without your consent. And what do I mean? Like, for example, if we look at medical data, which becomes a very recent problem, because, like, as you know, and also our audience in Germany, we have this long discussion about e-health and that our health insurance should be all digitalized and all health data should be digitalized and be connected and cool. The most people now think about, yeah, okay, my doctor described me something about the flu, and do I want my health insurance to have this data online, blah, blah, blah. But to make it concrete for reproductive health, when it comes to abortion, right now we are super stuck that abortion is illegal in Germany. I mean, you get no punishment in some cases, but it is illegal. And if this kind of data is collected and online and it's not safe, as our super cool called eAkte is not safe to this moment, what the fuck? Sorry for my mispronunciation, but what the fuck is happening? Then it's a super highly gendered risk for persons to, like, not yet, but it could be in the near future, as we saw in the US, go to prison for having a medical examination. Like, health workers could get in prison due to this data. So we need a very sensitive, very high data security plan for gendered issue. Also, the next thing is domestic violence or gender-related violence. Of course, you can easily get tracked by your phone, because your phone has not a safety by design setup. So your, for example, your Wi-Fi could get on and you can log into public Wi-Fi, which makes it easy to find you. Also, like Bluetooth or your, like, how is it called when you have like this, your location.
Yeah, like live location or something.
Yeah. You have your live location on. All of this is not in the setup disabled. It is online. So, like, this is another question. Like, how can we get devices which are collecting constantly data super safe for all of us? Because, like, gender-based violence is some of the highest risk for marginalized gendered people, like women, trans persons, non-binary persons, etc. And we have, like, no strategy. All I get to hear is right now, yeah, we need some new data policy to have, like, more data for innovation, stuff like this. And the idea is to, like, collect more data. But the ideas comes often from people who are not at a high risk if the data are exposed. I mean, they don't want it. They feel like if this would happen, they would feel bad about it. But it's not an existential risk. But for marginalized people, it is. And it becomes a higher risk if these people are not located in a democracy, but in an authoritarian regime, for example. And I think this is one point why I'm so passionate about data security, because I think it's also a kind of security for people in real life.
Yeah, totally. And we can also see how a democracy can shift to a different regime, and then this becomes very, very risky for some people. Not only the US, I mean, the US, I would still consider them as democratic. However, of course, the times are changing with Donald Trump compared to Joe Biden. Maybe looking at the data collection that you mentioned, how can gender equal data collection actually look like in practice? And how can this be achieved without falling into binary ways of thinking?
Yeah, thank you, Max. I think it is a hard question because how AI is structured nowadays, I would say it's not possible to have a feminist version of it because it's deeply colonial. It's depending on cheap, precarious labor from the global majority. It's depending on a huge amount of data, which often gains from illegal sources or due to force, etc., etc. It uses and consumes highly energy, water, and due to the data centers. And of course, you talked about this in a past episode, but I want to add that this kind of data centers are often located in poor communities, for example, in the US, also in Black and Indigenous communities where people have less access to resources, which helps them to get protected, to win lawsuits, etc. So I would say it's hard, but as I told you, I'm a utopian person. I'm being super duper into feminist cyber futures. And I would say there are a lot of grassroots activities. For example, there are some NGOs in Brazil who really works on their own infrastructure in case of server farms, their own office applications, which are super private and secure for human rights activists, but also for sex workers, like really prisons on a high risk of being attacked in the digital sphere, but also in the analog sphere. There are, for example, I would say also the union building due to Amazon, because we see a lot of union building there who really fights for better working conditions, which for me is like one good example of how AI could be more just, and which is not the totally AI logic. On the other hand, I would also say a lot of privacy attempts, which are funny and cool. There is like one workshop tool called AI was Strapped from the Justice League, which tries to be unrecognized by face recognition due to drag makeup. And I totally love it because community is getting to organize themselves. Also, there are attempts of collecting data about like very rare diseases in data sets and samples to really put forward public interest AI applications in the medical world, which really focus on this kind of diseases and helps people to, for example, deploy medicine. And one last word, I don't think that, for example, there are AI tools in the case of face recognition, which could be feminist. I don't think that just include marginalized people in face recognition and use it then for border control or for military use. I don't see that. I'm more the union person. I think unions in the AI business, yay. I think private attempts, yay. I think public infrastructure, which really relates to communities who are building it and who are using it, yay. I don't see commercial AI tools who relay on a little bit more diverse data sets. No.
Yeah, totally. So let's go a step further. Let's talk a bit about education. So when I think back to my computer science lessons, I mean, it was different times. So we learned how to open folders, how to open an email, and how to open a different document. It was very, very, very basic. So what role does education play when it comes to overcoming such structural data inequality?
Yeah, I love the education question. Good one, Max. And I also love the little story you have for opening the folder. Actually, I was in the Internet AGI. It was a task force for school kids who like learn to Google or open a web page. And I think it's super hard because now we all are digital natives. And like the next generation is even more. We shouldn't introduce them to a chatbot. They know it already. Yeah. What should we tell them? Here, you see a chatbot. Isn't it cool? And now you can type your question in. But be aware, the answer could be wrong or false. Yeah, okay, but what does kids learn about that? Their whole life is in the internet. I think we should start to like really ask ourselves, how do we want these kids to be online? What do we want from them? And I think the important part is that they're super aware of that most of these big social media platforms, for example, take their data and make money out of something they gave them for free. I think this is one important step. I think the other important step is to train kids to think of other futures. That social media, how it is nowadays, is not the end point of development. It's not how social interaction should function. Because like every study is, okay, social media, like it's not good for you. And I think we should encourage kids to think about how and what they want in the internet. Because if I talk to young students, like at university, and I'm telling them, okay, I think you should think of other forms, they'd be like, oh my gosh, I never thought about it. I can't imagine anything else than the good old social media I had right now. And I would say this would be a classical democratic education job. This is one. The second one is also about sexuality, because I think this is super duper important, because kids, teenagers have sex in the internet by sending nudes, sexting, etc. And if we as a democratic society has, thankfully, sexual education in our school system, this should be our one priority, because as we know, kids have sex. They will watch porn online. They will do everything. And I think this should be on our list, what kind of topics kids should know nowadays, like safe internet digital sex. And the last thing is that I think it's not just a question of coding and make your own AI bot, but also a question, for example, of art and politics in general, where kids should learn, okay, how could something look like, which I really want to use, which belongs to me, which makes it, for example, easier for disabled folks to interact in the internet, or also what could be a democratic way to design, deploy, and, for example, to run a huge platform where people like share their inner life. And I think these are like huge topics for school education, university education, which are not the classic. Yeah, they just need a little bit more IT. And then they are like all coders for our next decades or so.
Yeah, totally. Speaking of social media, just last week or the week before, I heard a panel discussion whether social media is still social. Also very interesting. You already mentioned those unions as a good practical example. Is there something very specific you can talk about as a good example in which gender has been systematically and also successfully integrated into the use of data? And what can we learn from it?
Oh, that's also a great question. I think on a systemic level, I can't. To be super clear, it's not the fault of the activist or of communities that they're not integrated in the big platforms, because like the platforms have the power, and of course, grassroots activists rocks and we love it, but there are like different levels of responsibility. So to say this before, there are, for example, an art project in New York called The Missing Archive. And there, the artist, I will look the artist up for you, Max, that the artist really collects missing data sets. For example, trigger warning, it's gender-based violence, murder, if you don't hear it, if you don't want to, please skip it in the next 10 seconds. Where she collects, for example, a missing data set about the persons or trans persons who are murdered in the US, which I think is like a very strong sign for what kind of data is missing and why it is important. And on the other hand, with an empathic feminist view on it, this for me is an example. Like really, read also what we have at the beginning says the complexity of data policies, that it's not just collecting more data about marginalized groups, but to ask wherefore, why, and how should we do it? I think also another great example when it comes to gender and data is a project where activists, for example, trying to organize and to develop an app for safe information about abortion here in Germany. I also will look up the name for it, Max. Therefore, we have not the classic data collection, but to have access to data and information about abortion. And I think this is like a good way to think in a feminist way. Like it's not about just random collection of data, but access to data, access to who is able to perform abortions, where I can get the access to, and it's all for free. It's very high privacy standards, so your data is secure, or at least how secure data could be in the internet. And it's developed here in Germany. So I would say this is one very good example for it.
Yeah, perfect. And you always say you are an utopian, and I love that. So looking into the future, is a gender equal future possible in the internet? And if yes, how is it possible?
Yeah, of course it's possible, because otherwise I couldn't do the job. Oh my gosh. But I love the question, because it forces me to think over and not just say, yeah, I am. First of all, I think there are always a possibility that things getting better. I also dream about it. I think it's also community driven. I think a gender equal future could just being achieved by communities, not by single persons. We saw it, for example, the Budapest Pride, where Orban like really forbids it, like what the fuck, but she does. And what the communities all over Europe and all over the world did was to get there, to have the biggest pride in history. And I think these are examples. And again, it's not the classical internet digital example, but I think this is how it works. I think also it's up for people in power to take up responsibility. Because if we look, for example, at the discourse about gender-based violence, people often say, yeah, we want to do more for protection of women. And I always wondered, because so many men are talking about it, and I'm always like, okay, but you're mainly the reason why nobody of them says, okay, I'm part of the problem. Maybe I don't perform act of violence, but I am part of the problem and I try better. I'm taking responsibility, and this is how it looks like. So I would say this could also be part of it. And it would look like that we start our morning with a super nice message from our beloved ones, and we don't feel exhausted by the first message at our phone in the morning. I think this would be perfect. Or that we have dating apps which allow us to have the sexual life we want and not to be afraid of doxing, of like people who are just dangerous to us or that we have internet discussions with a really good outcome where people don't spread hate, disinformation, stuff like this. It's very cheesy in the end. I'm so sorry for people who are listening, but this would be my dream to have, like, what I also dreamed about, a feminist society, free people, like, no one has to be poor, no one has to suffer, no one has to be alone. Yeah, this would be what a feminist internet future would look like. And nobody work for, like, huge tech concerns, because, I think it would be a better world.
I would totally love this future, and I would totally be a part of it, of course. So, I mean, we are still hoping and also actively working on it, hopefully, to have this future in the nearer future. But it will take time, but I'm pretty sure that people are willing to live in such a future. So, Katharina, thank you very, very much for this beautiful talk. In the end, I think I have learned a lot, and also our listeners. And thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you, Max, for having me here. It was such a pleasure and honor. Yeah, and now I'm looking so much forward for having this conversation online.
And that was all for this episode. If you'd like to hear more, subscribe to Data for All, A Quest for Digital Autonomy, in the podcast app of your choice, such as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or SoundCloud. And for any questions or suggestions, you can write to us at dataforall@boell-sh.de. The link is in the show notes.
Data for All, A Quest for Digital Autonomy, a podcast from the Heinrich Böll Foundation, Schleswig-Holstein.